I'm confused. What committee is this? We're in a strange room. The Senate Higher Education Budget and Policy Division will come to order on Tuesday, April 8th. And we just have one bill in our agenda, Senate File 3589, Senator Torres Ray. I invite you forward and introduce your witnesses. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This is my first time before your committee, so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important policy. Senate File 3589, Madam Chair, members of the committee, intends to establish a Teacher of Color Financial Aid Pilot Project. And this particular bill will allow for partnerships between public institutions and school districts. Especially, it will require partnerships between Winona State University, the Rochester School District, St. Cloud State University, and the Robbinsdale School District. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have several people, of course, who have come from those different areas to testify before the committee, and I'm very excited about this because early in the process, Representative Kim Norton, who is here today with us, approached me to have a conversation about achievement gap, and she knew that I was pursuing legislation in that area, and we started talking about the importance of recruiting teachers, teachers of color, and really studying. She and I have been working on these different areas, but we understood clearly at the beginning with testimony given to us by the university that teachers make a big difference and that we really need to invest in teachers' training. And Senator Wigger and Senator Stumpf, we had different meetings really to talk about the importance of providing training and resources for teacher training. So I'm very pleased to present this to you today, and I have several people who wish to testify. And I am going to call two at a time. So I have representatives. If you could please come. I have superintendents from different schools. I have the director of human resources for the Robbinsdale School District, Stephanie Crosby, with me. And I have from Rochester, the superintendent from Rochester Public Schools, Dr. Romaine Dolliman.
Welcome to the committee. Before you begin, let me just announce that this hearing is for informational purposes only, since we are past the committee deadline and have wrapped up our bill. But because this provision is in the House bill, I thought it would be useful for us to have a hearing and for members to be familiar with it, and maybe we weigh in on it informally so we would have some guidance going into conference committee. Okay, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Crosby, and I am the Director of Human Resources in the Robbinsdale Schools. As the student bodies of our schools become increasingly diverse, the need to recruit teachers of color grows ever more important. We live in a society in which almost one in three students in our public schools belongs to a minority group. However, only 8% of teachers are African American, and only 3% are Latino. The demand for faculty members of color is at its highest point, and the supply cannot even begin to meet the demand. Research shows us that students of color tend to perform better in class and face higher expectations when taught by teachers from their racial group. Teachers of color serve as role models and cultural brokers who help students connect to their school through shared identities and counter negative stereotypes portrayed in the media and elsewhere in our society. Teachers of color demonstrate to students of color that teaching is a viable career path. We have found that teachers of color are more profound. They are more positive impact on the achievement gap, and retention of students of color happens easily because of the culturally based practices, higher expectations, roles, and mediation and advocacy. I urge you to support this bill to address diversity and cultural competence, which means recruiting and retaining teachers that would have the ability to understand the students' culture and incorporate that into their classrooms. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What's the percentage of teachers of color do you have in the Robbinsdale School District?
Our percentage of teachers of color is less than 2%.
And what about your percentage of students?
Over 40%.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I went to Robbinsdale Schools.
Know that.
And I think we had one person of color in my high school.
When I started working in the district over 15 years ago, the percentage was about 10%. It has grown tremendously. Our demographics change daily.
Mm-hmm.
So we're well over 40% in the district.
Okay, thank you. Superintendent.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. And my name is Romaine Dalamont, Superintendent of the Rochester Public Schools. I would like to thank the Senate Committee on Higher Education for allowing me the opportunity to share my thoughts on the workforce issues related to teachers of color and why I believe this bill is crucial. I know that this is an issue that the entire state of Minnesota is facing. However, I'd like to frame my message or discussions with you this afternoon, specifically around the Rochester Public Schools. And also, I would like to share a little bit about my background to give you some information as to why I believe that this bill is pivotal as to what we as educators do on a daily basis. I have a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in mental health counseling. I used to work as a mental health therapist in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I became an educator because I was awarded a scholarship through a similar program at the University of Miami. I then pursued a master's degree in special education where I became an educator. Now, I can tell you that if it weren't for this scholarship, I would not be sitting before you today as the superintendent of schools. This bill is very important, and I am saying this not because I believe that only minority educators can educate minority students. However, we know that by having a diverse workforce, we have data to support that not only it benefits minority students, but all students benefit from having a diverse school environment. For example, in 1970, the city of Rochester used to have 150 minority families. In 1990, the Rochester Public Schools had 1,117 minority students. Today, we have over 4,300 minority students and only 33 minority teachers. This tiny pool of minority teachers is really not acceptable, especially since we are moving into an era where we have global competition. We are preparing our students not only to compete in the state of Minnesota, we're preparing our students to compete with other students around the globe, making sure that our students not only have the academics, but the social and emotional aspects of their lives met is also crucial. And as a result, we need to make sure that all of our students are well-rounded. And where is a better place to begin to give them the exposure to diversity than inside our schools? We need to make sure that we have diversity for our students, regardless of race, ethnicity, or socioeconomic status. We know that moving toward having a more inclusive and a more integrated school environment is beneficial. And there's data to support that students' performance also improve. Senators, I am asking to support this bill, not because I believe it's a nice thing to do, but because it is the right thing and the best thing to do for our great state. And let me close with a quote from Neil Postman, who says, "Education is not to educate the public, it is to create a public." We are creating a public. And we need to make sure that we prepare all of our students, not for our world, but for their world. And their world is a diverse world. We need to prepare all of our students for a multi-ethnic global economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We certainly do agree with you. And we have actually been supporting teachers of color programs at several colleges in St. Paul over the years. And we've asked them to come and kind of give a report and an update so we see how they're going. And it would be interesting to see how their appropriation compares to what your request is. And I also, Senator Torres Ray, did you look at a loan forgiveness approach at all, or why did you choose this approach, which is a grant during the junior and senior year? Is that what it is?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think we're, Madam Chair, in response to your question, we're trying to explore, you know, kind of different options. This is particularly important for areas kind of outside of the metro area and kind of suburban. I think that we've, through the years, have kind of put an emphasis on recruiting teachers and making an effort to recruit teachers within the metro area, particularly in your district and my district. But as I travel around the state, I see that really the need is greater than what I thought it was. I guess I was not never exposed to that until I came to office, that you know, we have really districts that are growing exponentially. So we're trying to explore different options. And as you said at the beginning of this hearing, I'm hoping that we can connect the current efforts that you have been pursuing through this particular committee. And so we're, I think, exploring different options. And I think Representative Kim Norton is here, too, so that she can speak to that issue.
Representative Norton, did you want to weigh in on this? Maybe you want to pull a chair up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kim Norton.
Representative Norton.
I will just give a little bit of background. Last year we did, in fact, pursue a very comprehensive bill that had loan forgiveness, which I think is important. I had some grants. Public and private. It was a much larger bill, and it, as you may recall or may not, it fell out in conference committee at the end. It was in the K-12 omnibus bill.
In the K-12 bill.
Yes, and it fell out, and we were told it didn't belong in the K-12 bill. It should go in higher ed, and at that point, the bill was already on the higher ed bill was already on the governor's desk, so it fell through for last year. Given this year's budget situation and the state's financial picture and outlook, I worked with the Department of Higher Ed over the summer, Susan Hegard and some of her staff, which are here, to try to say, how could we do this? And at their recommendation, we pursued a pilot instead. And knowing that some of our colleges and public schools were already beginning some of those partnerships, working together, Rochester Public Schools, for instance, has a future teachers academy that the K-12 program does to try to encourage students to go into teaching. And then WSU and the Rochester Community Technical College kind of piggyback on that effort and are trying to encourage students to go in. And so they have a nice partnership started already. But we knew that funding is still a crucial issue for many of these students, many of which come from low-income families. And so I will just also mention the junior and senior grant idea was really a way to use our money in the most efficient way. So many students drop out of college in their freshman and sophomore year. And since we knew we had very few funds available, we wanted to make certain that we used it in the best manner we could. So we focused on those junior and senior year students who've already proven themselves with 2 years. And the bill also has a tiny piece of recruiting from two-year colleges where at least I can speak, and I think it's true across the state, but in my area, there's high minority enrollment in many of our two-year colleges. And so we can approach and work with in partnership with those two-year colleges to bring our best and our brightest into our teacher programs in other colleges across the state.
And Madam Chair, thank you. Also, as you probably know better than I do, we have some issue with respect to retention of teachers of color. I think that there has been a significant effort to recruit teachers of color, but we are not seeing the retention and graduation rates that we would like to see. So we hope that with this small incentive, teachers will be able to the students will be able to graduate. A lot of the students, for instance, that we here attend Metro State University right now are adults who are working, and sometimes it gets very complicated for them to continue to pay for higher education. And so we're hoping that with a small incentive, these students will make the effort to not only to enter, but to finish and graduate. And I think some of the higher institutions, higher education institutions, are here to testify, and they might be able to speak to you about the need to provide incentives for graduation, for retention and graduation.
Senator Torres Rea, Representative Norton, on page 2, subdivision 3B, it says a grant up to $5,000. Is there a ceiling, like tuition and fees, or how is that going to work? Up to a maximum of to have their tuition and fees paid for? I don't quite understand. Who's going to determine how much of that? It's when it says up to $5,000 each year.
Would you like me?
Yeah, please go ahead, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure of your protocol, so I don't want to step on toes here if I do it incorrectly.
Just wave.
Okay. The $5,000 was chosen as an amount, and it does say up to. I think part of that had to do with some students come with some either loans or grants or other scholarship programs, and so they were talking about a ceiling, and it was to be determined by the Department of Higher Ed. That's who issues the grants. So they would manage the portion of it, and I believe you'll see in there that they do ask for a small amount of money for administration, and we've added that in. So that would be determined by the Department of Higher Ed. And the $5,000 is not certainly going to pay for a student's full tuition, but that was the amount recommended both by research and the Higher Ed Department last year, and I just kept that same amount this year.
Okay, so I think we might look at maybe developing some criteria to give the Office of Higher Education guidance if we were going to do this. The other question I had was on 2.25, the pilot partnerships. Who's going to decide on what partnerships get approved?
Madam Chair, two of them are already identified in the, a little further down, Winona State and Rochester Public Schools, St. Cloud State and Robbinsdale Schools. And part of that was because we kind of didn't all call through the HR, public schools, HR departments, what school districts were interested in this, and some stepped forward immediately. Since that time, Bemidji State University and Bemidji State College and Bemidji Public Schools have also shared interest, but it was after the language had been drafted. And the higher ed department recommended that we use this language, and then they would have a process for folks to apply based on a partnership that met those criteria.
Okay, we should probably say that there. And then are private colleges also eligible to receive money for their students?
Madam Chair, they were not in this bill, and part of that was because last year when we carried the other bill, there were the three programs that were already going through St. Thomas, Hamline, and one other school
Concordia.
That were private colleges only, and we felt they had been addressed, and so we were trying to reach public at this point.
An anti-lapse. What are you? Just make a note of that.
Okay.
We don't have to say that. It's too technical. Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, it does say on 2.15 that the director must give priority for grants under the section to students who are eligible for the Pell Grant or state grant. So that goes back to Senator Pappas's question about is the $5,000 when we did the Power of You hearing, they said that there was about $1,100 that most was the average amount that students would have to pay who were Pell eligible for tuition and fees. And so
That was everybody. They include people who aren't Pell eligible in the Power of You currently.
Right, right. But I think they said that if you were Pell eligible, the difference that they had to make up was about $1,100.
Well, Senator Roebling, I talked to the staff about this, and the Pell Grant does kind of phase up. So if you get the full Pell Grant and the full state grant, that totally covers your tuition and fees at a two-year college. It's as your family income goes up and you get less of a Pell Grant or less of a state grant that they needed more money to backfill that.
Right.
So when they say Pell eligible eligible for the Pell Grant, it doesn't say the full Pell Grant. It can be any Pell Grant. So that could go up to what? When does the Pell Grant phase out?
Income-wise.
Depends on how many family members you have, et cetera.
Generally around 35,000.
About 35,000 family income. So it's still pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, I'm sorry. So, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
So just wondering about the 5,000. So it does say on line 2.9 that it's up to 5,000. But like you pointed out, is it tuition and fees? Or if they're getting the full Pell Grant, do they still get the $5,000 even if their tuition and fees are all covered?
Good.
That's right. What I'm trying to figure out.
So the question is, are you trying to also help people with their living expenses so they don't have to take out loans? Representative Norton.
Madam Chair, potentially, yes, that would be the case because they won't be going to a two-year college at this point. They'll be going to a full four-year college with a teacher preparation program, so their expenses could be higher.
They might have to live away from home.
But that's why we have the cap, a maximum of 5,000.
Okay. And you said that in the version last year, you did look at was it a combination with loan forgiveness and grants? And
Madam Chair, yes. Last year, actually, I started out the process with it having been loans that then would be forgiven.
Right.
After they teaching so many years. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a scholar loan, if you will, that if they went into teaching would get paid back for them. If they didn't go into teaching and they went off and did something else, they would still be responsible for the loans. And frankly, the higher ed department had a little bit of concern with that because it's a management issue and tracking the kids down. And they were very much more supportive of giving the $5,000 grant flat out rather than the other option, which I guess I personally felt gave the students a little more onus and accountability, but certainly did provide a lot more work for the higher ed department.
Well, it'd be interesting to hear what the situation is with some of the other colleges at St. Thomas and Concordia. You know, what kind of subsidy are you giving your students, and what if they decide not to go into teaching? Is there any kind of a payback then, if the whole point is to increase teachers? The same thing with Metro State. If our students getting any kind of a stipend, and what happens if they drop out of the program? So we'll wait and hear from them. Any other questions about the bill or about the proposal or for our witnesses? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Torres Ray. On line 2.11, it talks about satisfactory progress, and again on line 2.22, it talks about satisfactory progress, and I wondered if you had any comments on what that really means.
I think we have. Didn't we ask that at some committee meeting? We had a definition, but is it something like a C minus? I mean, we might have to ask the college people that. What it is.
Yeah, we will have, Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, we will have some people testifying in a moment and they may be able to respond to
your question. Have more testifiers?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't have anyone else on my list for you, Senator Torres Ray, so.
I got a list of
I think we have
But it's not for her, it's for the other programs.
I think we had, Madam Chair, I think we had some folks come from Rochester and we weren't sure they'd be able to make it up here. And George Thompson is kind of here representing WSU, which is the Rochester Public Schools partner, and Blandon Foundation, if you have time for them.
Okay, well, we better move on then.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you all very much. Okay, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you.
Go ahead and bring forward your other people.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I have Mr. George Thompson from the Blandon Foundation.
Mr. Thompson, welcome. Could you just introduce yourself again, please, for the tape?
Yes, my name is George Thompson,
and I'm from the Blandon Foundation, but also have been a resident of our community for 40 years. A few minutes ago, Dr. Dolleman talked about families that were in Rochester, and we were one of them some 40 years ago, and the demographics were tremendously different. Madam Chair and members of the board, I want to speak to basically two issues. One of them is that there is a huge need to have minority instructors for a variety of reasons. Just read a couple of comments that I did in a report to Winona State in terms of the need. The continued lack of minority teachers means a lack of racial role models, heroes, and authority figures for minority children. It means an ignorance of minority children's learning styles, cultures, social, educational, and psychological needs. It's a factor in the disproportionate number of African-American students suspended and expelled from schools. A diversified teaching staff not only increases the number of role models for students of color, it also provides opportunities for all students to learn about ethnic, racial, cultural diversity in our rapidly changing world. It'll provide cultural brokers to help students understand and maximize their school experience. Students of color tend to have higher academic, personal, and social performance when taught by teachers from their own ethnic groups. Teachers of color also have higher expectations for students from their own ethnic group. And the supports for these claims come from the National Collaboration of Diversity in the Teaching Force. The example of Dr. Dolleman a few minutes ago is just an example. Dr. Dolleman has come into our community, and I would also add he has an extremely busy schedule. But he took the time to come up and share this because it's very, very important to us in our community to understand the impact that this type of a bill can have in our community. I want to talk a little bit about foundations, and I simply want to say that foundations that are very effective are working on systemic changes that will make changes not now but also in the future as well. This is a process that needs to be a portion of systemic change. We've got to change the if you look at the student demographics, Dr. Dolleman talked about some of that change. In the Rochester school system, I believe it's 2020, we expect to be 50-50 in terms of minority versus non-white students. That change needs to see people that look like them. And there are a lot of other things that I could point out along with that. But what I would say is this, that we absolutely need funding. I've asked a number of folks around the state when I conducted this study, how much funding are we putting into this type of a project? There is very, very little. I asked Susan Hegard if she would help me with finding out more about this, and she did. She provided me with excellent resources, but there is not a lot of funding going to minority teacher programs. Without funding, there is no project. In the foundation community, if something is important to you, you have to allocate the funding to make sure that that happens. I'm going to just close with just a simple thing. You remember the old oil commercial that said, pay me now or pay me later. We have an opportunity to catch this on the front end by increasing the number of minority teachers, providing role models, and converting kids that could potentially go into our prison system into taxpayers. So I want to leave you with that message, and I thank you for the opportunity to present some information along those lines.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Thompson?
She wants to comment on this.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then did you have something? Someone from Winona State?
I was a representative.
You are from Winona
yes.
State. All right, thank you. And I met Mr. Thompson at Winona State. Nice to see you again. All right, any more questions on the bill? And I'd like to hear a couple people who have also asked to testify on this legislation, and that is Stacia Smith, if Stacia's here. And Ms. Hegard, why don't you come to the table too, because you wanted to comment on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Stacia Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And thank you for the opportunity to comment on this. I've talked to both Senator Torres Ray and Representative Norton on this bill, and we oppose this Senate File 3589 because of the funding source. We don't have any opposition to the actual program, but it's important to note that the funding source does take funds from the state grant program. And the chamber supports the state grant program. It allows limited state dollars to go towards low-income students so they can go to the post-secondary school of their choice. And it's my understanding that that program has not been touched before, so taking even a small amount would really set a precedent for future decisions and would begin to erode the state grant program. So my concern is that even though this sounds like a great program, as does the Power of You and some other ideas, if we start down this path, there won't be a hands-off the state grant program in the future. So I would just appreciate if you would consider that in your decision-making once this hits conference committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Smith? All right, Ms. Hegard.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Susan Hegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and probably seems odd for me to be before you testifying, in essence, in opposition to a bill that we helped the author with, but our agency does that. I mean, if a legislator wants help crafting a bill, we will work with them no matter what party they're with or what house they're with. And we also work with staff if they want to do runs on various, you know, scenarios. We always will work with staff and members on issues. That doesn't mean in the end that we ultimately will support the effort.
Well, we definitely appreciate your cooperation.
We did work in a very positive way. Folks from our staff, Tricia Grimes, Cheryl Mapplethorpe, and Nancy Walters back here, helped Representative Norton craft her proposal. And so one of the things I did want to say is that I think it's great that you're having this hearing today to hear about these various approaches to trying to increase the numbers and quality of teachers of color. We know that there aren't enough teachers. We know that there are some strategies that work, and I think trying to determine that, figure out what works and what doesn't, is really important. And I think it's great that there are lots of different programs, there may be some things that you pick up from the hearing today that would help us, you know, across public and private higher education, begin to approach this in a different and more effective way. Again, the concern, I raised it when we were talking about the Power of You program. I've had an email exchange with some of the folks from MNSCU and the MCTC, Metro, and St. Paul College about our concerns, again, that it would be an unprecedented erosion and taking of the Pell Grant money. It's really the source of revenue for this initiative that we're terribly concerned about. Mm-hmm. And although it's a small amount of money for the Teachers of Color program, the Power of You would basically take $4 million of the 15 that Congress historically increased. It was a historic increase in the Pell Grant for states. We're getting $15 million. It's, I think, $400 to $500 a student that comes along with that money. So we're really testifying in opposition to this revenue source for the program. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Ms. Hegard? Okay, then thank you very much, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, Ms. Hegard. And, you know, I was aware of the concerns that you had about the funding source. But I will just say this, that we cannot continue to do business as we have traditionally done. And it requires us to look at the very limited funding sources that we have and consider whether or not there are different or alternative ways that we can utilize some of those dollars. And while this might not be conventionally how we have chosen to utilize those resources, I would suggest that it might not be all that much different in terms of what the net impact here is to reach students that have some need. And this is a way that we can reach those students and at the same time be proactive and address some very real needs that are facing this state.
Senator Lynch brings up a good point. Ms. Hegard, when we're looking at how we might, are there changes we need to make in how the state grant works to meet the needs of students? Now, this is a good consideration. Maybe there are times where doing something that's more targeted, especially if there's a workforce issue involved, might be something to look at with the state grant. We have a shortage of science teachers, or we have a shortage of people in technology. Doing a loan forgiveness or a targeted grant program, why would that be so terrible in violating the state grant?
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, we're in the middle right now of a study that you in the Senate and the House asked us to undergo, looking at the state grant program. We're right in the middle of that. We've submitted to you, I think, in January, an initial draft report. We're asking for feedback on the report for a final report, I think, due in the fall, if I'm not mistaken. So we're happy to hear from folks if there are suggestions or improvements that need to be made. But I guess I would just reiterate my concern that this would be the first time that you'd be taking it's federal Pell money. That's the only reason we have money here, $15 million that we're talking about, is Pell grant money, and that's money for the very poorest students. It's a historic increase in the program. Because we have a state grant program here, we integrate the two together. And I'm very concerned about this setting a precedent, whether it's the Power of the U or the Teachers of Color program. It's not kind of I don't know a delicate way to say this. It's sort of just saying, here's this pot of money. Let's start finding needs, you know, and spend the money on these various things. And while they may be relevant, I think it ought to be discussed in a context that's with some consistency. So if you want to have it be part of our state grant review, I think our office would be very happy to take a look at some different scenarios, some different ways to address workforce issues. But I'm worried about just sort of having bills come in that begin to pull away at different parts of this program. I'm very concerned about that.
I guess, Ms. Teagard, I have tended to agree with you in the past, so I'm kind of challenging our assumptions. I think you're right with on line 2.35, the Teachers of Color program promotion, using $25,000 for administration does not seem to be appropriate use of the state grant. But if all the other money, it's not going to the program, if it's going to the student, it's just like with the Power of You proposal. It was going to the student. And now maybe we needed to have more, since our state grant has been need-based and it has been open to all students. Maybe that's the direction to go, to broaden that to be more consistent with the state grant. But, you know, just like family responsibility or student share may help one segment of the student population more than another, for example, if we raise the cap, that doesn't affect the Minsky Institution students at all. It just helps a certain segment of students. So why this is something that would help a certain segment of students, I'm just kind of laying out that option.
Madam Chair, if I might, when we raise the cap, we affect, though, all students in that particular category. So all students at private colleges, all students at the University of Minnesota would benefit from the cap being increased. It's not selecting schools. It's all students who attend those schools in that category. The same thing when we increase the student share or we do something, tweak another aspect of the formula, that might benefit all two-year students at public institutions, or it might benefit private college students, but we benefit all students in the category. This bill, like the Power of You, targets specific institutions to benefit from the program. And so what you're then creating, I would argue, is uneven amounts of money for students in a program that is meant to treat students in a particular category similarly.
Well, and I think the Minsky students make the same argument. When we raise the cap, is we are then only helping the private schools in the University of Minnesota, and it's not serving students in the Minsky institution. So I think there is some similarity there. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And I had heard something, and I don't know, maybe Ms. Heegard knows, that Congress, in appropriating the additional Pell money, is raising concerns now, and I think there may have even been some hearings on this, because all states are having financial problems. And they want to make sure that Pell money is being used to help low-income students, is my understanding, and that there may have been a regret that they haven't been more precise as to where they want that money spent, and that there may be changes to their law so that states can't just use it in their to generally subsidize a college I don't know. Did you hear the same thing?
Madam Chair, I think, Senator Roebling, we did talk about there's a Kennedy Amendment that's been discussed that would sort of a maintenance of effort. It's along the lines of maintenance of effort. It says to states, if you don't maintain effort, if you don't spend the money, federal money, on its intended purpose, we will penalize you in the future regarding those monies. So there has been discussion, I think, among members of Congress in both bodies about that.
Any other questions for Ms. Hegard or Senator Torres Ray? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move on.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
I'd like to move on. We want to hear now about some of the existing urban educator, minority educator programs, and let's start with the Dean, Doug Hennis. You're not actually a dean, but he's the dean of the minority teacher programs. I've worked with Mr. Hennis for many years when I was in the K-12 committee and their collaborative urban educator program at St. Thomas University. And could you talk to us, in your comments, would you talk to us kind of about best practice and how you recruit and retain minority students in your teacher training program?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for inviting us to attend today. My name is Doug Hennis. I'm Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. With me today are colleagues from Hamline University and Concordia St. Paul. I'll give you a very brief overview of our collaboration, our consortium that we have, and then each of us will briefly describe our programs and how they work. St. Thomas, Hamline, and Concordia have worked together since 1997 in coming up with programs to try to encourage more people of color to pursue a teaching career. And the legislature, in fact, through the K-12 bill, has funded our program since 1997. In the first several biennia, we received collectively about $2.6 million. The last three biennia, we received about $1 million. The programs that we have essentially are designed to deal with the ever-changing demographics in our K-12 schools by encouraging underrepresented populations, particularly people of color, to pursue teaching careers, and then providing them with the tools that they need to be successful in the classroom. We work very closely with school districts to design our programs, and again, we're grateful to the legislature for its support in the programs in the past. The St. Thomas program is called Collaborative Urban Educator, the acronym being Q. We established it on our own in 1991. It's a post-baccalaureate program targeted to people who are interested in a career change. Their average age of the students is typically in their early to mid-30s, and they have pursued full or part-time programs at St. Thomas to get a license to teach. And then they are placed in public school districts. We have 330 alumni of our Q program. 76% of them are still teaching today. They're still involved in education. And 68%, or a little better than 2 out of 3, are still teaching in the Twin Cities. So our retention rate has been very strong. Of those 330 alumni, about 80% have licenses in elementary or secondary education, and 20% in special education, which has been more of an emphasis area for us in recent years.
And, Mr. Hennis, what percentage are people of color?
89% are persons of color. We have teachers, as of right now, in 112 Twin Cities area schools, 15 different school districts. And right now we've got 25 students who are pursuing a special education licensure. It's an 18-month program. They'll get their licensure in June of 2009 and, again, be placed in public school districts here in the Twin Cities. So, you know, we think we've got a pretty good program. We're running on 18 years now, strong retention, and a good track record in recruiting people. We're very active in going out to school districts and working in communities. A number of our teachers, actually, or students for the program, got their start as tutors. One of our alums is Bernadia Johnson, who is the chief academic officer for Minneapolis Public Schools. She used to work in banking and at 3M. So it gives you an idea of the kind of career change that we've been able to affect with people. But anyway, I want to move on and introduce Dan.
Before you move on, Mr. Hennis,
yes.
Could you tell me that of your appropriation, you know, what percentage is used in direct aid to the students, like scholarship aid or stipends, and then how much you use for the administration of the program or the teachers?
The funding that we receive in this biennium, St. Thomas is getting about $320,000. Most of it is used to cover their tuition costs and to pay for a full-time administrator for the program. And then St. Thomas picks up all the indirect costs related to the program.
So how much are students then paying on average for tuition?
They're not paying anything for
they're
tuition.
Not.
It's a tuition-free program, right?
Senator Sharon, sorry.
Thank you. Would you tell me again, did you say your funding is out of the K-12 budget?
Yes. It's always been, Senator, it's always been out of K-12. The feeling, and there's been debate, K-12, higher ed, and the feeling has always been that because we're educating teachers for K-12 schools, it's most appropriate that the funding come from that particular committee.
Members, when I authored this bill years ago for Mr. Hennis and the others, we tried to make an argument, Senator Sharon, that half the money should come from the higher ed division. Senator Stump was the chair then, and he didn't
go for that.
Okay, thanks.
So.
Yes, hi. I'm Sally Boss, and I am the director of the Southeast Asian Teacher Program at Concordia University, St. Paul. Our program is a little bit different than the one at St. Thomas and the one at Hamline because we are recruiting people who are already working in schools as paraprofessionals, as bilingual interpreters, or as non-licensed teachers. And we are welcoming, we are 100% a program for persons of color. We draw about 65% of our students come from the Hmong community, and the rest come from places like Africa, Russia, and Somalia, and other places. And we are welcoming those students to come in with what we call a circle of support. So we're supporting them as they come in. We work with them and have a seminar with them on Friday nights, which might seem like an odd time for us to meet, but it has become the SEAT family. We have a very high retention rate and a great graduation rate. 92% of our students that have come into our program are out teaching in Minnesota schools, and others are teaching in other places around the United States as well. 94% are teaching in Minnesota schools. We have, this is a bachelor program for us, so we are working at that first level. So consequently, it costs more when you're working with students who are coming in without any education, any higher ed on their part. So that's been an important part of the Southeast Asian Teacher Program. What has grown even from this has been partnerships around the metro and outstate area for a program called Hmong Culture and Language Program, which has become like a model program for our pre-service teachers to have an opportunity to do some teaching right on campus with these students. And we welcomed like 900 K-12 students to our campus last summer, where the students in the Southeast Asian Teacher Program provided the instruction for those students. So the program really has been, we've been heavily reliant, of course, on the funds from the legislature, and we thank you for those funds. And we look forward to continuing the program because we know as we're reaching out into the community that we're making a difference for the children of color.
And Ms. Boss, how much of your state funds go toward the students and how much toward administration?
Let's see. We have about 20% actually that goes to administration. The rest goes to the students.
And your students pay tuition?
Virtually, they don't end up paying tuition because of other grants.
And how many students have you graduated and are they all Southeast Asian?
No, they are not all Southeast Asian, but 65% of them are Southeast Asian. And so we've retained the name Southeast Asian Teacher Program because that's the way it has started. Mm-hmm. About 100 of our students have graduated, 165 have come into the program, and the remainder are still working on their licensure.
And those that are graduated, how many are teaching?
94% of them are teaching in Minnesota schools.
Wow. Great. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Boss? All right. Mr. Loritz, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Loritz, Vice President for University Relations, Hamline University. I'm here for Frank Hernandez, who's the director of the program, couldn't be here today.
We actually thank you all for coming on very short notice.
So Hamline... prepares pre-service teachers, teachers of color. We do that through our College of Liberal Arts. The program I'm going to talk about today, however, is in our Graduate School of Education. It's called the Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching. We started this program in 1994, just after St. Thomas had started their program. Our focus is not on preparing, in this program, is not on preparing new teachers. We deal with teachers that we say are in the gap, meaning they're in the gap between being hired and achieving tenure. And the reason we were attracted to this program and found it something that we should invest in is that there was too much of a dropout of new teachers of color from the time that they were hired until the time that they achieved tenure. And so our focus is entirely on teachers who've already graduated. And we want to make sure, as we work directly with teachers, school districts, and schools, individual schools, in partnership, is to make sure that we increase the retention of new teachers of color. So we work very closely with St. Thomas and Concordia and other schools. In fact, as school districts hire teachers of color, whether they hire them from other states, they hire them coming in from other places, we are very focused on trying to support them to be successful.
And this is very important, the retention angle, because 50% of our teachers quit within 5 years.
Right.
Of teaching. They don't, only 50% last beyond 5 years. Right. Is that still the statistic?
Yes. And for teachers of color, it it depending on the location could be higher or lower than that.
Okay, any questions for the panel? Senator Tomassoni.
Chair, this for any, it seems that these programs have been pretty successful. Mm-hmm. And according to some of the witnesses from Senator Torres Rey, there's a real lack of teachers of color. How much more can you ramp up your programs so that, or is there a need to feed into the system?
We would love to ramp them up. We're really the funding is the issue for us.
Is it for
Senator Tomassoni? I would say the same thing. We did a lot more than 25 students. Per biennium when we had higher funding levels. We had a full-time program that it's kind of been put on the back burner for right now, in which we are also able, in working with the school districts, to provide some living stipends to the students in addition to covering their tuition because they just couldn't afford to quit their jobs and go to school for a year. So the funding cuts have hurt our ability, I think, to put more teachers into the system.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Tomassoni,
are these teachers that graduate from your programs, are they ending up in school districts that have the need for them, or are they go anywhere they want? I mean, because there's obviously some school districts that don't have an issue with
it. It sounds like every school district has a need for
That's what I was going to say. I think every school district has a need. We have in the past had, when there was funding, we had partnerships with St. Paul's schools and Minneapolis schools, but that funding is no longer in place. But we still continue the partnerships, even though the funding is not there. And we have been trying to get students out into not just the metro area, and I think we can all speak to that because our programs are very collaborative in nature, that we try to get our students out all over the state where they're needed.
So your program's funding was cut in 2003, but it was never restored
right.
2005 or 2007.
That's correct.
Right.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator Tomassoni, the funding was up until 2003 about $2.6 million between the three collectively, and then that was cut back to a little more than $1,056,000 for the last three biennia.
I might also say that Hamlin has moved out to seek corporate support, and Travelers has been very generous to us in their support of this program, along with other foundations in Minnesota. And we've also moved to more of a shared funding relationship with the districts in which we work. They're currently employees of their districts and have a real vested interest in making sure that they're successful. But if we had additional funds, we would be able to do much more than we do now.
So Mr. Hennis and Ms. Bass.
That's okay.
Could you just give us a why are your programs successful? Just a few bullet points.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think a lot of it has to do with personal attention. Gene Mortensen, who directs the program now and is sitting behind me, he's been involved with it for many years, and goes out and personally recruits people for the program. We get a lot of, obviously, a lot of calls. We advertise for the program. We meet with people and make sure that they're really thinking they're doing the right thing by pursuing this. Because, again, in many change, in most cases, they're going through a career change. They're going to do something different with their lives. So I think they come into it perhaps with a little more commitment than a normal student might make. And then I think there's follow-up work. We have a very strong networking program, both, you know, while they're in the program and then once they get out. So we stay in touch with them and get a chance to work closely with them in the years after they've left the program.
And your program is 1 year?
Right now it's 18 months.
It's 18 months.
We have run both 12-month, which is considered full-time, and 18-month programs. The one cohort we have at this time is an 18-month program for special ed.
I guess I would ditto that, saying that it's the relationships that keep everyone there. I spoke just briefly about the seminar that we have on Friday nights, and that is the time when our students come together, and that has become known as the seat family time, and no one misses. They don't miss because that's the time that they come to learn from each other about how do you get through certain classes when you're a second language learner? How do you, who at the university provides support? And every program has a significant person, like Gene is for that program. There's someone like that in every program. For my program, I'm the mother, and they call me Mom Boss, and they come to the program. But, you know, it's about not only providing them support as they come in and as they go through, but it's also providing them that strong encouragement to finish. And we have students that have a hard time finishing. When you're a second language learner and you spent your early years in the jungle in Laos and you didn't learn your first language, coming here as a second language learner is very difficult.
Now, your students, are they like assistant teaching in school?
They're working
during the day
as,
and then they come to you like from 4 to 9?
That would be right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's a two-year program?
It's a four-year program because it's a baccalaureate program. So we have been as late when our funding was reduced. We have been taking in students who already have a little bit of college education. So when we were hearing earlier about working with community colleges, we do that. We work with those community colleges as well to make that bridge into the baccalaureate degree. So it's a very important thing to be doing to provide that and to be working together. And I just have to, if I may just add one little thing. When I read this bill and it said that $5,000 in the junior year and senior year, what it said to me triggered in my mind was the many times that my students have come to me and said, I don't have any money, so I can't stop to student teach. I can't stop working because I don't have any money to put the rice on the table, so to speak. So extra funding at those times is critical.
Yeah. Okay, any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank
very
you.
Much, and nice to see you all. Our last program we're going to review today is the program at Metro State, the Urban Teacher Program, and we have a team here that are coming forward. Two-person team. Welcome to the committee.
Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.
Thank you so much for the opportunity of being here today. My name is Carmen Cobayes Vega, and I'm Dean of the College of Professional Studies at Metropolitan State University. And with me is accompanying me is my president, William Lowe, who is currently yes. Thank you very much. And I'd like to provide some information, as requested, regarding the Urban Teacher Program at Metropolitan State University, and also share with you the opportunities, I guess, and the challenges that we face in the preparation of teachers of color that are consistent with the challenges that were enumerated by Senator Torres Rey, and also my colleagues that are here also from the other universities and also from the P-12 schools, the challenges that they're facing with respect to meeting the needs for urban learners. and the diversity of the learners that we have in that demographic mix currently. The committee has been given a copy of our legislative report that we submit on a yearly basis regarding the Urban Teacher Program. You have the full report, but I'm really just going to make some highlights from that report to provide some information. And since I'm not sure how many people really know the history of this program, I thought I would just give a quick overview of that so you understand how this program was developed or created. In the spring of 2000, the 81st legislative session established an appropriation of $1,250,000 for the development and implementation of the collaboration. And it was to be a collaborative program in urban secondary education and urban early childhood teacher education offered by Metropolitan State in partnership with two of the two-year schools. And that was Minneapolis Community and Technical College and Inverhills Community College. That partnership is still alive. We continue to work together. Since then, however, we also have developed some articulation agreements with Century and St. Paul College around some of our programs that also provide feeders to the four-year program. The legislative mandate essentially indicated that the urban teacher program was to come up to a standard of 50% students of color in our program, that we would prepare these teachers at a 50% level. And that was part of the mandate. So when the program was initiated, we were working very fast to get to that point and developing the program. You have to remember, too, you know, as I've been in teacher education for many years, there are programs that have been in existence for 100 years, 50 years, many more years than the Urban Teacher Program. So it's a relatively new program. And essentially, we started from scratch with developing not just the programs, but also hiring faculty and the support for those programs. That would include support staff as well as field experience coordinator. Currently, we have a fixed-term recruiter that helps us with that recruitment strategy as well. The vision, which I think is very clear about this program and what it's meant to do, is to prepare diverse, reflective, and resilient teachers who are outstanding in their commitment and ability to meet the needs of historically and currently underserved urban learners, schools, and communities. And that's a very clear vision of this program. And therefore, with our partners, we work together to assure that culturally and linguistically diverse urban learners experience high academic achievement from preschool to college. The mission is twofold. First, to increase the number of well-prepared teachers of color in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and inner ring suburbs so that the urban teaching workforce reflects the ethnically diverse population of students and their communities. And two, to empower urban teachers with the content knowledge, pedagogical skills, urban field experiences, and professional dispositions needed to improve the educational achievement of historically and currently underserved urban learners and to advocate for their right to receive a high-quality education. That is certainly quite the task that we have at Metropolitan State, but it's one that we embrace fully, and we believe that we are accomplishing that task. Also, in terms of the numbers, because we've talked a little bit about the numbers from the other institutions also, we have currently in our admitted pool 128 students, and of those, 52 or 40% are students of color. And that will increase next year in terms of the admission, the students that are being admitted into the program. We also have in a category called the pre-admitted students, both in our undergraduate and a post-baccalaureate option that we have, a certificate program, 174 that have indicated an interest but have not fully gone through the admission process. That alternative pathway, by the way, the post-baccalaureate option, and you've heard from our colleagues also that they have individuals in their midst who are also pursuing, who are those career changers. We have those individuals also in our program who already hold bachelor's degrees and are intending to become teachers. We also have, of course, individuals who already have licenses and are pursuing other licensure areas.
Dean, for those career changers, yes. Do they participate in the full program is 2 years? Do they participate in the full program then, or do they have a truncated program?
They have a truncated program.
For those with already a bachelor's
yes.
degree.
They, in some cases, they are in some of the same courses in terms of the methods, but in other cases, they're not. Their introductory courses are different.
So are they 12, 18 months? What are they?
Right. Well, it depends if they go full-time or part-time, okay. And many of them really do come part-time.
If they were going full-time, it would take them how long?
Probably less, maybe a year.
A year, okay.
Yeah. Could be. But because of the path and because of the historic nature of Metropolitan State, we have many adult learners who are working full-time, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult for them to take time off. In fact, the majority of our undergraduate students are part-time students. We do have some full-timers, but the majority are part-timers. And they do, characteristically from what the three institutions that have the funding to help support the students currently, it's a similar kind of thing in that the students really are struggling with that issue of the financial need because many of them are parents, have families, are working full-time, and it's very difficult for them to manage that student teaching semester. I'm jumping to the end of my presentation because I know that you have time constraints, but to say our students are very, from the number of surveys that we've conducted, are very pleased with the design of the program, the content of the program, and especially the diversity of our faculty. Over 90% are faculty of color in our program. And we don't have that many faculty, and we certainly are continuing to build our faculty, but they value that kind of expertise of individuals who've been out in the schools and now are, of course, professors at the university, but have that experience. They also value the curriculum because the multicultural and culturally competent educator is very much embedded in the curriculum of the Urban Teacher Program. I would say that we've also had a number of wonderful developments for a program that has developed over a short period of time. We have managed to get through all of the Board of Teaching requirements for program approval through 2014. We've submitted to the Board of Teaching our elementary education program for approval, and that should be coming up sometime late this spring or summer. So we will have the full P-12 programs at our institution. We are also working on an endorsement in English as a second language, which is a tremendous area of need, as well as special education. So that's to come later. But I want to reiterate the fact that the needs that have been expressed are absolutely compelling regarding funding for not only students of color, but the teachers, those individuals who are prepared to serve urban learners. That is a very compelling case that we have. And even though our students do have financial aid, a majority, 60% of students at Metropolitan State receive some form of financial aid, it does not begin to cover that student teaching experience. And we've already had discussions with our wonderful partners. We have great partnerships with St. Paul in Minneapolis and some other schools that also work with us who supervise some of our student teachers in the inner ring. And we've been discussing some creative ways that we can address this issue of how to help support individuals during that student teaching semester. What winds up happening more often than not with some of our students of color in our program is that they stop out when they get to the point of student teaching until they find a way to be able to do that. And it's just unfortunate. It's highly unfortunate. So when you look at the numbers with respect to some other programs that do address urban teachers, individuals who want to become urban teachers, our program probably falls short from the perspective that our ratio of completion is probably half of what theirs is in comparison. So
what is it, actually, Dean? Of 105 students that have graduated, how many are teaching?
I would say what we have in the aggregate, when we look at all the numbers over time, 82% of the white students and 17 or 18% of the students of color are actually employed. And when I say to you that 40% of our students currently are students of color, my expectation is, given the track of what's happened, we will be very blessed if actually half of that 40% actually gets to completion, licensure, and getting placed.
So
their placement has not been the problem for us in terms of getting them out there. Mm-hmm. It's the issue of that student teaching semester.
Okay.
We have some that, excuse me, let me just finish this one thought. We have some that decide to graduate and then go out, and then sometimes they're able to seek a position on a waiver and then finish a student teaching assignment. That sometimes has happened. But it's really important to have them finish as they're just finishing that program, so you have that continuity. And so this is really compelling. Now, we don't have any additional resources for students aside from the financial aid that they get. We have been able to establish an endowment, but that only generates $10,000 a year that we can disperse. We have been creative about going to some foundations and trying to access some dollars for that student teaching semester specifically, and have been somewhat successful with that. But I think it's an issue that I think we have to figure out some solutions for, definitely. And so I really appreciate the fact that this has come to the open as a discussion piece for all of us. And I would say, as far as all of the certainly in our program, but certainly in the state universities, it's an issue that we're seeing come up over and over again, especially as those individuals who want to teach in the urban schools who are non-traditional students and our career changers face these challenges.
Well, we are very interested in hearing what the problems and barriers are, because we want to have more students, more student teachers of color. And I guess I would be curious to find out from Mr. Hennis and Ms. Bass how you handle your student teaching year and how your students handle that. Maybe you could just come and address that briefly, and then I wanted to get back to Dean Vega. How do your students manage to do that and teach and work and have such a high rate of actually teaching? Ms. Mortensen, welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Jean Mortensen from the University of St. Thomas with the Q program. Our program is a cohort model, which means I have a group of people going through in either that, what we used to use as a 12-month full-time program in which we offered a stipend, but people did not have daytime jobs. We currently have an 18-month program that leads to licensure and special ed. People keep their day jobs, and they come to class at night. So they're able to at least financially keep working to build some sort of reserve so that when they do the final clinical practice, they cover some of those expenses either through savings, but there's also financial aid that they can use at that point if they wish to take out.
Financial aid for they can living. Take out a loan?
Yeah.
Basically for that.
Right, for that time that they're doing the clinical practice, the end piece.
Okay. So you work with them to figure that out?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right.
Ms. Cobias-Vega, I'm trying to understand this. the numbers. So in your report, you said that you have graduated between the fall of 2003 and 2007, 105 students. And how many of those students were students of color?
About 17%.
All right. Percent, whatever. Yeah. And how many are teaching?
All of them are working in either teaching or education related.
Okay, because I was confused when you said, I thought you said 18% of the students of color you graduated were actually teaching. But that's not what you said.
No.
All right, so it's not as bad as I thought. Okay. It was confusing, right?
And
so
you, know,
you only... Yeah. Okay, so even though you had maybe 40% students of color, less than half of them ended up completing the program.
Well, when I'm saying 40% is currently of the students that are there, when I was giving you that data, that was data from 2002 to 2007.
Okay.
Aggregated data, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah. That period of time. And if you, as you think about 40% currently students of color that are in the program, when we started out, we didn't have that many students of color. We had primarily white students when we started the Urban Teacher Program. And over time, that has begun to shift as a result of the recruitment and the admission and being able to attract
individuals. So when you started, you were like whoever walked in the door. And
exactly.
Since then, you've been more
exactly.
aggressive in recruiting.
Exactly.
Okay.
Did you? I'm sorry.
And I'm also yeah. interested in kind of identifying, and maybe you have done that in your report, some of the barriers or some
yes, there are
internally
some
within the program, and also externally in terms of physical,
yes.
in terms of financial assistance.
Yes. Yes. And you know the financial aid issue. I was kind of interested in the discussion earlier. Because of financial aid issues, the way financial aid is packaged, it takes into consideration all of the expenses that students have for their education. But when you look at a student teaching semester, which is very unlike some other experiences where you can't work, I mean, it's very, very difficult to work when you're essentially at schools from 8 to 3:30 or 8 to 4. It presents a real challenge to how do you augment your income and what do you do with if you step away from your job, you may not have COBRA coverage, for example, for your family, for health. So there are other kinds of issues
right.
that you have to take into consideration that I think merit some discussion in addition.
And those are things that students need to be aware of so that
Absolutely.
They can be preparing that you know, maybe their financial aid has covered their tuition to that point, and at this point they may have to take out a bridge loan
right.
to get them through that. And it, yes?
Yeah, I would just like
Could
to
you introduce
this
yourself?
This is Sally Boss from Concordia
yes,
University. I just would like to offer a model that we have been trying out recently to address that need because our students are the same. And so the model that we're trying is a longer student teaching for half of the day.
We've done that too.
So that seems to be one of our ways to address that because then the students can perhaps stay in their own school, student teach in the morning and work their regular job in the afternoon. But that has to be in agreement with the principal and others there. So.
And we've done a model similar to that with some students, and we do have students. We share the same kind of students that are currently working in the schools. Yeah, yeah. So.
Oh, so you said you are also recruiting students who have jobs in the public schools?
Yes, yes.
To be part of this program.
Head Start and in the public schools who are EAs.
So some people can student teach in their very school where they're an EA.
Well, we won't go there because
okay.
there's a lot of other issues around.
Okay.
They may not be in their same classroom, you know, but there are other options that we present maybe within the same district
okay.
and those kinds of things.
Okay. All right. Any questions from members of the committee? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to comment?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
thank you very much.
That was a very thorough, very interesting hearing. Very good to hear from all of you, and hope that we might be able to do more in this area, if we can't this year, in the coming years. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And I know that there was discussion about the drop-off rate, and some of that may be attributable to the financial situation of the students. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, and I still have some hang-ups about not doing it as a forgivable loan, because we may be giving money to students who never end up in teaching otherwise. I do have a concern about that. Mm-hmm. And the Nurse Loan Forgiveness Program, and almost all of the programs we have developed so far to try and recruit in certain areas have been loan forgiveness programs, and we, because of the need to make sure that they actually end up in that field.
Ms. Hegard, could you tell us what are some of your issues with loan forgiveness programs? Why does the agency have kind of a feel like that those are difficult to administrate? Maybe Ms. Grimes can enlighten us.
I'm going to ask Madam Chair Susan Hegard, I'm going to ask Tricia Grimes to speak on my behalf on that issue.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, loan forgiveness programs there's not a lot of evidence that they really work. For one thing, students already have quite a few opportunities to get some of their student loans forgiven if they have federal Stafford loans or federal Perkins loans and they teach in a Title I school or they're teaching science or math. And so a new program doesn't always get their attention if it has more strings attached than the existing loan programs. Loan forgiveness also requires tracking students over a very long period of time because usually you give them some time after they graduate from college to fulfill the requirement. There was a program called the Paul Douglas Teacher Scholarship that the federal government had and repealed in the late 90s, which tried very hard to get high-ability students to go into teaching, but then it charged them interest from the day they first got their grant, their scholarship, if they didn't happen to get the right kind of teaching job in the right kind of school when they happened to graduate. It's very difficult to know ahead of time whether the right kind of job will be available at the time that a given student happens to graduate. So those are some of the kinds of issues that come up with the loan forgiveness programs. Did that answer your question?
Okay. Is that a well done?
But Madam Chair, I still have a concern about it, especially given that there was a fairly high drop-off rate with some of the
Well, I think in the Metro State case, those students did not receive any special stipends or anything. They just got their regular Pell and State grant. There was no more that was received. I think we heard from St. Thomas and Concordia that their students were going tuition-free and that the state money was being used for them. But they seem to have done a very good job at retaining their students and graduating them. You know, I think what we're trying to figure out is with this new program, this Metro State program, what they could do, you know, maybe what they could learn from St. Thomas and Concordia that are more best practices to improve their recruitment and retention. And maybe they do need more stipends for the students, especially during this student teaching period.
Because, Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling,
I know that high-achieving minority college graduates are in demand
High
in
demand.
A lot of fields,
right.
And they could have a lot of choices once they get their degree. And, you know, looking at the salaries of a starting teacher or another business opportunity once they have that college degree, I mean, we may lose students there, too.
Right. Well, I think with I don't want to speak for the programs, but I think with the private colleges, there's probably an extensive interview process to make sure that their students are really committed to being teachers. And that's what their goal is in life. And so I think that's an important part of the process. Okay, thank you all very much. The meeting is adjourned. We could ramble on a little longer.